May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be free from harm. May all beings love life. May all beings awaken. Welcome to another Cuke Audio Podcast. I'm DC Poobah of Cuke Audio and Cuke Archives, preserving the legacy of Shunryu Suzuki and those whose paths crossed his. I pray that you and yours are safe and comfortable and able to get out and do whatever it is you want within the limitations of the universal precept of do as little harm as possible. Today we're going to have a guest, Ken Ireland. Ken's an old friend, and he was a Jesuit. Part of our talking to people have some connection to Christianity, more than just a casual one. During these Christmas days. And he studied with Claudio Naranjo and Isan Tommy Dorsey, Richard Baker, John Tarrant, and right now he's living in Dharamsala. So we're going to hear about that and various things just as soon as we have had our pause to meditate. But first, I'm going to tell you a little tiny bit about how this podcast was made. So we had, Ken and I had various obstacles in our path before connecting the other day. I couldn't call when I was supposed to, then he couldn't talk, then he couldn't hear it because he was making ice cream. He said there's no good ice cream where he lives. And so he is making ice cream and so forth. But then finally we connected. And there were problems with our connection. If calling the U.S. or Canada, then Skype to a regular phone works great because I pay yearly and it's quite affordable. Anywhere else, I like to use Messenger or second choice Skype to Skype because they're free and they're good programs for each of them for recording the calls. And those recordings put each of us on a different track. So that's great for editing and making various adjustments. Now, that's good unless there's a bad connection, like when I called Ken in Dharamsala. So, in the Himalayan foothills. So, finally, after, multiple attempts, four of which I saved some. I don't know, the first 20 minutes or so of the podcast is from those first four. But I have subjected you, dear listener, to a little bit of what we went through when it started breaking up, and then I call him back. I apologize for that. And for Doggett Bandito, who was barking at somebody outside. It's pretty distant, but it was on the audio. When you hear the bell, hit pause if you wish, and then meditate for as long as you wish or not. And when you're through, hit unpause, and we will hit the bell to end the meditation. And we'll give Ken a call. All right, calling Ken Ireland somewhere in India. Hi, Ken. Oh. I don't have my microphone.
David on. Chadwick.
Yes, there we are.
Hi.
Ta-da,
hi,
we connect.
How are you?
We connect.
Good. We are connected, yes.
We both had things happen that interfered with us, but finally we were reunited.
Very nice.
So, where are you right now?
I am in a village called Yogiwara. Which is about, which is just about 250 meters below the Dalai Lama's residence in Himachal Pradesh, McLeodgunj.
Oh, it must be awfully cold.
And I'm looking out at the mountains. I saw a picture of His Holiness sitting on his balcony, and we look at the same mountain.
Ah.
Very nice. Yeah.
It must be very cold.
It's freezing. Yes. And these buildings are like made of not stone. They're poured concrete and mud, and they conduct cold like a refrigerator.
Oh, wow.
So it's that, you know, so you're in warm, lovely Bali. The sun is shining, the ocean is coming in, the water is nice, and it's very temperate, and I'm freezing my gazookies off here.
Ha! Well, it's a rainy season, and it rained all night, and it's sort of cloudy now. But that's nice, too, because it's I didn't even have to turn a fan on till 10:30 this morning.
Ah, lovely.
Sitting out. Yeah, nice. Well, now, I spent 33 days there in 2003, loved it. Really great exercise just living there because it's on an incline. I'm leaving a little bit of the distortion in the audio in so you can hear what I was dealing with on this end with his poor internet connection, which dominated. Oh, good Lord, the first hour of us talking. So I'm going to extract from that what I can. But we finally got a solution to it.
Yeah, it's very hilly. Yeah, very, very hilly.
Oh, yeah, I got
it. I mean, when I say that is hilly, meters away, it also is a 15-minute walk uphill. So yeah.
I got to where I thought nothing of going all the way down to Lower Dimpitsar, or up higher, up and down. Oh, it was so good. But my impression was that most people left at this time of year. I didn't hear you. Did you say anything?
Well, nothing because of COVID lockdown, obviously. Most of the foreigners at this point, the expats, would probably have already gone to winter.
Hey, I think we lost connection there for a second. What did you say when I said I thought most people left at this time of year.
Yeah, most of the ex we're locked down here with COVID, of course. So no, and we travel is now permitted interstate, but most of the expats I know have stayed here and are not going to. Usually there would be a mass exodus to Goa for the winter.
Oh, I
Yeah.
see, of course.
Yeah,
Yeah.
but this year no. This year we're all staying put. I don't even go out of that my house. I'm in a total lockdown retreater. I have my food brought in. My shopping is done for me. Even my banking. I had to stay off the call for a bit because my Hariji, who's the guy I rent from, is also a cab driver. He went to the ATM, but I had to have the phone free for the signal that, it wasn't somebody stealing my money.
Where Diane, I got lived up there a little closer, I think, than you are, right?
No, Diane, no, my house is right. My house, I know, I rented Diane's house for the first two summers that I was here
Oh.
before with Ashish. So she's only, that house is only, is, I can look out my window and see it. It's
Oh.
probably 35 meters away.
Oh, far out.
I'm above her. Yeah.
Oh,
So
far
you know
out.
her. Yeah, I'm in that village.
All right.
Exactly.
Now she, then I know where that is. She had a guy help her who I really liked, and his name was Hari, and he lived right there.
Yeah, he's my landlord.
Same guy?
Yeah.
Oh, tell him hello
Yeah.
for me. I really
I
liked
will.
him.
Yeah. Oh, he's wonderful. Yes, of course. Yes, that's Hari Singh. He and his wife are, I have a picture on my Facebook page of Hari and Reshma putting Christmas lights on my weird looking tree.
Oh, my.
Yeah, so the connections are very close. Yes.
Oh, wow, that's great. That's great. And how is the COVID in that area?
Well, we had one woman in the village die. She was 63. And she very sad. So that's we and her son is positive. We have a couple of the monasteries have been infected now, but they're in total lockdown also. Nobody goes in or out. The streets are pretty empty except for the Punjabi tourists on the weekend who have to come up and party because they have to. I mean, it's a little bit like the US. There's less than about 60 cases, I think, totally in Dharamsala, in upper, we're called sort of like upper Dharamsala, Gulabganj, Dharamkot, Yogyakarta. 60 cases, maybe 60 to 100. My favorite restaurant was closed down because all of her workers got sick.
You said about 60 to 100. Well, that includes the little villages further on up there.
That's the three we're three big three three vill well there's smaller villages in between, but the main are Dharamkot, Cloud Ganj, and Yogyakarta. They're the three up on the hill, but there's also Nadi a little further up, and I don't know, I haven't checked in if there are any cases up there. Of course, everyone knows exactly who's infected, and people go into self-quarantine, and the rest of the community brings some food, and so it's very cooperative and lovely in that sense, but it's still scary. And of course, they're very concerned that His Holiness not get sick.
Yes.
So that's where major precautions around that.
How far off are you from a vaccine?
From where? How far are we away? They say that we'll have a vaccine here for health workers and people over 65, which is me, I'm 76 now, by the end of January.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Everybody gets good care. It takes a long time, but it could break down very easily with a huge onslaught of people. And I don't want to be part of, bringing the hospital system to a halt if I get sick.
Oh, yeah, that's
Yeah.
true. That's true. Very
Yeah.
well said. Yeah, that's true. All right. She also said we would probably get the Chinese vaccine or one that's being tested now that's made in Indonesia.
Well, we're gonna get we're getting I think we're getting COVAX. It's manufactured here in India. I'm not sure. But I'll have to ask Hari. I get my news is rather incomplete because I do have Wi-Fi and VPN and all that stuff, so I can get some Rachel Maddow and MSNBC and a little bit of things on US news, but most of the news comes in Hindi, of course, and I don't know Hindi, so I have to rely on Hari and my cook Bablu.
Are you there? Uh-oh. If I don't hear you in a minute, I'm going to hang up and call back. All right, there we are. I'm going to call you now. So that's the end of the first call, and now I call him back. That didn't work. And so it took a few times, and we got reconnected again. Here we are again.
Hello. We're connected again?
Yeah. Look,
Oh, good.
that's all right. We could do it bit by bit.
Yeah.
Ha ha. All right. Well, I wanted to hear your way-seeking mind story. That, you know what I mean, right?
Well, not really. Elaborate. What do you want me to talk about?
Well, now I know you through the Zen world,
Right.
but I know you were like a Jesuit before
I
that, or
was a
what?
Jesuit. Yes, I was a Jesuit. I was a Jesuit. I entered the Jesuits in 1966 and I left in 1977. I was 11 years a Jesuit. I left the year that I would have been ordained. So I completed the course of study. And I did the retreats and everything, but then when it came time, I decided I didn't want to live a life of celibacy, and I said to my superiors, I said, I don't know if this is going to work, and they said, would you take a year and pray about it? And I said, okay. So I was what's called exclaustrated, meaning I could live outside the community. And I went and took an apartment on Alcatraz in Oakland, near Berkeley, with a guy named Hal Slate, who was a psychotherapist and in Claudio's group with me.
Oh,
And
yeah, Claudio Naranjo.
Claudio Naranjo. And we lived there. And at the end of the year, I went to the superior and said, yes, I'm leaving. And I signed my papers. I actually didn't just leave. I did the whole process and was formally dismissed from my vows and stuff. So, yeah.
And how was that received?
How was that received?
Well, yeah, I mean.
Well, I mean, well, the Jesuits at that point were losing, losing 6,000 a year.
Wow.
To marriage and people running off and people getting disheartened and dropping out of the seminary and priests running. So it was, and I think at the time I was, or maybe 6,000 a year is a lot, but there were like 40 40 to 50,000 Jesuits, and by the time I left, there were 36. And now there's
Wait a
under
minute.
30,000.
You mean
So, yeah, so
worldwide?
people were leaving, yeah, worldwide. So people were leaving quite quickly. And so it was like, oh, okay, another one, you know. They were, and actually the Jesuits were always very decent with me.
Yeah.
They're very decent, you know. They allowed me to study with whatever I wanted to study, and I just had to keep basic vows and you know, be part of the community and like that. Yeah. So the Jesuit part was, I have great respect for the society. I think they're great, and you know, about as good as you can get in the Christian end of things. And yeah, so I have a lot of admiration for many Jesuits, and I don't certainly have too many regrets about the time that I spent with them.
Oh, that's nice. How did you come, what led you to deciding to decide to become a Jesuit?
You know, when I was about, I was brought up in a rather non-religious household, and my mother was not. My mother was a very anti-clerical Irish person, and my dad was a non-believer, a free thinker, was Protestant. And I remember when I was we were driving up from our house in Connecticut up to a ski resort in Massachusetts, we passed and I could see the Jesuit novitiate out of the car. And I said, oh my God, you know, I'm gonna wind up there. I was 11 years old or something. And I did. It was one of those flashes of, oh, I just knew I would wind up there. So at some point they didn't want to send me to boarding school, and they wanted me to go to an Ivy League school. So okay, you know, I'm so, and that happened. But they sent me to Jesuit prep for 3 years in Fairfield, and I met some Jesuits there and knew immediately that I was going to be a Jesuit. But my parents asked me to finish college first, which I did, and then I entered the Jesuits.
So your parents were, I mean, it's an unlikely
Oh,
story.
they're totally opposed to my being a Jesuit.
But it sounds like they supported it. I mean, they sent you to a
No.
Jesuit high school.
Well, they did just because they didn't want to, they didn't want me to go away to boarding school, that's all. It was sort of the best choice. I don't know. It was one of those quirky things that happened. Who knows why, what the reason was. I think my mother regretted it for after I entered the Jesuits. They certainly did not support my going to the Jesuits at all. And my dad was really pissed off. Yeah.
What did he do?
What was my father?
What did they both do?
Like work or?
Yeah.
Yeah, my dad had a my mother was a middle, you know, upper middle class housewife in Connecticut, and we lived in a very kind of posh suburb. And my dad had a company. He was a metallurgist who worked for the Pentagon during the war, and after the war he started the Second World War, that is. After the Second War he started his own business. So he had a small metallurgical company, which in southern Connecticut did very well, put me through college and, you know, boats and all kinds of things, and had a nice lifestyle. So yeah,
Where'd you go to college?
I went to Dartmouth College.
Oh, wow. You're deciding to become a Jesuit. Was there a religious impulse in that? A spiritual quest?
Sure, of course.
Like what? How would you characterize it?
Well, you know, I remember it's funny because I'm sort of going through some of that stuff now while I'm up here on retreat. And when I was a I read the Life of Ignatius and was really impressed with his conversion and his
Who?
finding God. And
Wait, say that again. Would you? It broke
Saint
up.
Ignatius, who's the founder, Saint Ignatius is the founder of the
Oh
Jesuits.
yeah. All right.
So I read his life and I did the spiritual exercises, and thought that it probably would be. And the other part of it was, as looking back on it, is in many, many situations and many people, many men that I know, being gay and wanting to have a religious life and oh, excuse me, excuse me, and not having to have our mothers explain why we're not getting married and having children. And the obvious solution is the priesthood. And
And after a couple of minutes of frustration, I lost you again. Hi.
Hi, it works better when I call you.
Oh, well, maybe.
So just on a, you do know that Mel Weitzman's dying, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
It's
okay. It's well known, yeah.
I've
Yeah,
done
well.
three podcasts with him this year.
Yeah. He's such a great guy.
It's going up on Cuke What's New today. I don't normally post that sort of thing, but it's public now. And I asked, well, can I post this? And they said, yeah, please do.
Well, he was I had only four or five different encounters with Mel over the years, and they were all just lovely, even though he is like he's kind of your boring uncle on some level. But and I never found him very exciting sort of as a teacher, but there's sort of a certain kind of reliability that's always present with him, at least that's my experience.
Yeah, he's a real priest.
It's getting a little weird here, but your sound. Can you still hear
Did
me?
yeah, I can hear you.
No, it's
You
very
talk, you
strange.
talk, you talk,
No,
because it's recording
it's
me.
very strange. Very strange sound. No, can't hear you.
Or can you hear me
Not
now?
little better. What have you
Well,
done?
look,
Have you adjusted?
look, Ken, you don't have
Yeah.
to hear me. I don't have to talk. Tell your story. I hear you good.
You hear me good? Well, where did but I use your prompting to get me to talk so that I can, say something that's reliable or that.
You became a Jesuit,
Yeah.
and what did you learn from being a Jesuit?
When we were interrupted here with the on and off back and forth with the connections between India and Bali, think about Nietzsche's method of error. It might be the fourth.
Can you hear me? I've lost you.
There we are.
All right, let's try this. I want you
Yeah.
to repeat everything you said in that last call, where I started off asking you what you got out of the Jesuits, and you told me about the meditation experience.
Yeah. So, all right. During the what's called the long retreat, which is 30 days of silent prayer. You meditate for maybe 9 hours a day and you do other exercises.
And you basically, it's divided according to spiritual, Ignatius's spiritual exercises, 4 weeks. So in the last week, there's an exercise, contemplation, contemplatio ad amorem. So the contemplation to attain love is how it's usually translated. It's more, it might also be translated, contemplation to reside in the love of God.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a contemplation about gratitude. And sort of surrender also. I haven't been through that in a long time. I might go back and look at it. Anyway, in it, he describes some methods of prayer. And one of the methods, I think it's the third or the fourth, is basically to reside in your breath, to say one word, contemplation. And during that time, I completely, you know, I was, I had an experience with samadhi. I could only describe it. I think that that's what it was, having learned the term now in Buddhism. Wow, it was like I disappeared. And I was gone, and my body disappeared, and they had to come in and kind of pick me up off the floor at the end of the meditation period. And I had no recollection of where I'd been. So it was really, and then I, of course, continued my rational, very programmatic kind of training as a Jesuit, learning languages, learning philosophy, learning theology, you know, learning critical thinking. It was a good education, but there's always behind it that kind of mystical experience. So in some, I'm always grateful for that part of the Jesuits.
Yeah. That's good. The two Jesuits I've known are Jerry Brown, or Jesuit initiates, or whatever you call it, and Ty Cashman. Did you ever meet Ty?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. God, I know Ty well.
Ty was, but I've lost.
I knew him. He was doing koan work with John Tarrant.
With John Tarrant.
And we were on retreat.
Retreat.
Yeah, very great guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Jerry Brown told me that the... he was at Tassari. He said the motto of the Jesuits was Age Quod Agis, which means do what you're doing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always remember that. I mean, that's just a beautiful way to express, you know, bringing meditation into your daily life.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And there's a few other Jesuits. The Jesuit spirituality is very, very wonderful. And I still, you know, I still use it a lot, for sure.
What was your path from being a Jesuit to Zen?
Well, so the intervening part of this is
Claudio Naranjo
and Berkeley, and I was doing my theology studies at Woodstock College in New York City, and I lived in a small community with Avery Dulles and some other Jesuits, and we were going to class at Union Theological Seminary and Woodstock, and it was the Upper West Side, New York City, West 102nd Street. Remember very well, one night this young guy from Chicago came by, who was another theologian. His name was Ron Partika, I think. Maybe I can't, I've lost track of him, but he was a Jesuit scholastic, and he had been working with Bob Oakes in Chicago. Now, Bob Oakes was a Jesuit who was in Claudio's first group.
Claudio Naranjo.
He's person, Claudio Naranjo, correct. And Bob Oakes is probably the person most directly responsible for the enthusiasm for the Enneagram of Fixations. I don't know if that's going to ring a bell for anybody, but that's what Claudio was working with. And so he described one night he came, he said, oh, we're doing this course with Bob Oakes, and there's a nine-pointed figure, and we kind of look at our personalities, and we find out what motivates us, and we kind of work with that, and we use it daily contemplation. And then we had this...
Lost him here, and then he comes back with...
I haven't got to Claudio yet. I'm still in New York.
Yeah, I know.
And I'm still with Ron Partika telling me about the nuns taking off their clothes. Said I have to go join that group. For
right.
some reason, there was a period of freedom there. And I go, oh, and there was also...
Yeah, the audio went bad here, too. So I came back in and said... Bob Oakes, or whatever, they told you about this... the Enneagram that Claudio Nerano was working
yeah.
with, and they told you about
yeah.
a retreat or some sort of session or something he did, and he ended it with telling everybody to take off their clothes. And there were males and females, and there were priests and
oh,
nuns.
Yeah. yeah. And everyone just took off their clothes.
Yeah.
And he said,
that's what kept happening. So we almost gave up. We'd had like four or five attempts with Messenger. That's, you know, me calling him or him calling me on Facebook Messenger. And we'd get some down, which you've heard, and then it'd go, start going bad, and we'd try again. So this last one was Skype to Skype. But still, that had to depend on his internet. So then I realized I'll call you your regular phone number on Skype. And that worked. And then we had like 40 minutes of, I think we had a problem right at first. And we thought, oh my God, it's going to happen with this too. But then it was all right after that. No problem. So that's what we're going to go into now is me calling him with me calling Skype and on his regular phone line, not depending on his internet.
There you go.
This one works. Ta-da! All right. So,
there you go.
You were in the Jesuits. You had this incredible meditation experience. And then you met these... met with these Jesuit scholars who told you about Claudio Naranjo, who was
yeah.
in the San Francisco area, who worked with the Enneagram. And
right.
they told you about some sort of retreat he had. And there were Catholic priests and nuns in it, where at the end he had everyone take off all their clothes, and they all did.
Yep.
So.
And apparently it was a very... And I think that Bob was sort of still blown. That experience was like in June or July, and I met him in August. And the experience was still fresh in his mind. And he said, you know, there wasn't anything sexual about it. Everyone just kind of took off their clothes. And but he said, I still remember this phrase. He said, the nuns folded their habits even kind of reverently and carefully put them on their chairs. So I had this picture of these nuns taking off their habits, being naked in a mixed group, and carefully folding them and putting them on their chairs. That image still just kind of like, what the hell is going on, you know? And yet there's a kind of freedom about it. Something about that conversation moved me, and I knew I had to work with Bob. That's simple. Are you still there?
Yeah. Keep going.
So the next day, I was already in the Jesuits for, I think, seven. This is my seventh or eighth year. I had finished philosophy. I'd done my work at Harvard and architecture. Learned, you know, I'd follow the course of studies, but I was really unhappy. And, the, you know, within 10 days, I was in a car with a total stranger driving across the country from New York to Berkeley. And I called Bob Oakes and I said, "Well, Bob, how are you? I'm Ken Ireland. I just arrived from New York, from Woodstock College, to work with you." And he said to me, "Great. Why don't you join the group?" And I said, "What do you mean join the group?" He said, "Why don't you work with Claudio?" And I said, "Can I?" He said, "Yeah, call this number." So I called the number, and Claudio's assistant picked up the phone. And she said, "Yeah, come to this group meeting on Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. And she gave me an address on Hearst Avenue, I think it is, in Berkeley, an old fraternity house. And I went there and joined the second group that Claudio had started working with the Enneagram. And I worked with him for 5 years.
Oh, my goodness. Really? Wow.
Yeah. So that was 1972. I worked with him from that time until he stopped teaching. So we were, and that was, we did therapy and we did Gestalt. We did the Enneagram. I learned Tai Chi. And I started sitting Zazen because Claudio recommended it.
Mm. And how did you start sitting Zazen? What did he recommend?
He sat down and gave basic very basic instructions on Zazen. And he said, just sit. And it was like it was kind of a very basic thing when you'd walk into the teacher. He said, just sit and we'll do this and do this at home in your house for 45 minutes in the morning and 45 minutes in the evening and keep notes. And I did.
Hmm.
At the same time, he introduced us to this odd fellow named Yogi C.M. Chen, who had just arrived from India. And he had been, and Claudio introduced him as a high tantric initiate. And so Yogi Chen, whom I became very friendly with, was a Chinese guy. He'd been a classmate of Mao Zedong. And he went to Tibet in 1929 and had worked with all of the major schools and done all the retreats. And he was probably the first real Buddhist that I met. Mm. And he was an interesting fellow and very, very much into the Tibetan tradition. But he kind of lived the meditation life. I mean, he was the real deal. Mm. And he was a wonderfully odd character. And I would go to his apartment on Shattuck Avenue and sit and talk with him. And he gave me some very basic meditation instructions. And I started doing that meditation. And then and Claudio also introduced us to a guy named Giribabsa, who was a Thai monk who had taken off his robes and was teaching Vipassana meditation to groups of lay people.
Mm.
And I did a 3-day retreat with him. So all this was in the Jesuits. I was working with Claudio, but we were doing Buddhist meditation as well as working with the Enneagram and psychological work.
Mm.
And I was very much drawn to meditation, for sure.
Hmm. Hmm. And this is like the early to mid 70s.
This was, yes. Yeah. And then in 1976, when Claudio stopped, no, Claudio had not stopped. Anyway, Hal and I moved to Berkeley. And Hal, my friend Hal Slate, who was also in Claudio's group with me,
mm-hmm.
We moved to Berkeley. We moved to San Francisco to the Castro, and I met Harvey Milk, and I started being a gay activist.
Oh.
Mm. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. So at that point, it was like I had to say, okay, I think this is my life. My life is here no longer with the Jesuits. And I was gradually setting that whole part of my life aside.
Yeah.
And that took a long time.
Mm.
The Jesuits have an incredible effect on people.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get into it, immerse yourself in it, you know, it becomes a way of life and a way of seeing the world. And I still think it's like that and still valuable. Mm. Yeah.
I remember Harvey Milk. I remember him passing out leaflets on the street. I think he came into the Tassara Bakery.
Of course he did.
And a very sweet guy, very sweet.
Yeah, he was. Mm. He was also an oddball, but yes, but wonderful.
So what was your first involvement with Zen?
So Yogi Chen died in 1980. I think it was 1987. Yeah. And I had, you know, I'd driven a cab and I'd done Gurdjieff work and I'd started a furniture company and I had a boyfriend and we were on again, off again, fighting and life was weird. And at some point, his name was Terry Regan. We were breaking up and we lived on Pierce Street in San Francisco. And I just got it into my head that I should meditate.
Yeah.
And so I'd heard about Hartford Street Zen Center, which was about a 6-block walk from my house.
Mm.
And I heard that they sat meditation at 6 o'clock in the morning. And so I got up and went there and I sat in the meditation hall and I sat facing the room. Actually, I was the only person in the hall, and Isan came down when the bell rang and he bent over in my ear and he said, "We sit facing the wall." I said, "Okay." And so I faced the wall. And I started meditating, and I started going to Hartford Street every morning.
Mm.
And that was my introduction, and that was after Yogi Chen died, and there were some other circumstances involved, but it was weird, and I just sitting there, and within 6 months, Terry and I had broken up. Within the next 6 months, I had moved into Hartford Street.
When did you move into Hartford Street?
Oh, I moved in 1980, it was 88 or 89. Isan had just started assembling the people who would be with him starting the hospice. And so the first people were there in the hospice. The two men who were there. Actually, I was came just before the second person, who was Bernie Ortiz. The first guy was already in the hospice, living in Isan's room, and Isan was taking care of him. And I moved into the attic, and within a year, I was directing the hospice. Steve Allen arrived on the scene. Steve Allen and Angelique Farrow were there. And then a little bit later, Shunko Jambles arrived from Hawaii. Phil Whalen moved in about 6 months after that. And I was there for 3 years.
Hmm. That's really interesting. I went over there some in 87 because I was running the kitchen over at Page Street. I always enjoyed going over there and seeing Isan. He and I were pretty close. We'd been roommates at Tassara.
He's wonderful. He was an absolutely amazing guy, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
He's just so lovely.
Yeah.
Such a lovely human being. Yeah.
And yeah, and he was so calm. It was like he'd say, you know, you'll get more done if you slow down.
He had a very and a very lovely way of dealing with people and conflict and yeah, he was just great. And of course, it was a very difficult time because you know, AIDS had started taking off, and there were close to 100 people a week dying in the Castro. And he knew he had to start a hospice. So I was there right at the beginning of the hospice. Yeah, it changed my life.
And then Isan was positive, HIV positive, still,
Oh,
and he was 86, 87.
probably 85, 86, yeah.
85,
But he
86.
really stays, yeah. He said, and he was still functioning quite well when I moved in 88, 89. It was a year later, 18 months after that he started to become very much debilitated.
So when you left the Hartford Street, where'd you go? What happened then?
So I was totally burned out, you know, in three in the 2.5, 3 years I had been there, I had held more than 80 people who died. Mostly younger, yeah, it was a lot. I mean, we would have 5 or 6 people die a week. We 80, 83, 83 people I counted at one point, I remember, had died in the 3 years I had been there, including his son, of course. And, you know, life, it was really hard going, yeah. And Phil decided to move the hospice out of Hartford Street, and I helped start the independent Maitri Hospice with this guy named Bill Asseltine, who was the director of the was the board chair of the board of directors. I remember him quite well. And then at some point I said, okay, I've had it. And Angie Runyon was supposed to come in and take over as director. What happened to Steve? Steve had left, I think he went to South Africa or something. And yeah, so there we were. And I said, I'm out of here. And I'd always wanted to go to Honolulu. So I was off to Honolulu and I found an apartment in Manoa Valley and met Bob Eakin. And started going to the Manoa Zen Center before it moved to Palolo. He gave me the first, he gave me Mu as a koan. I started working with Mu. I had already done session with Ed Crestone before I met Aiken. I had done maybe two or three sesshin, as you call in the Soto Shu San Francisco Zen Center says sesshin, and of course the more strict they say the more strict Sambo Kyodan says session, so they done the sessions with Bob. I think I did maybe 15 sessions with Bob and had done about 4 or 5 with Dick Baker. And then I started working with the koans, yeah. And then from there, when life in Honolulu, when it was really tough for me to find work and support myself, and Honolulu being very expensive, I moved back to the Bay Area and found some work in nonprofits and started working with John Tarrant.
Yeah, and that's when, I knew you before then, but I got to know you better
Right, when I came,
when you
when you were up on
started.
living on John's property. Yeah.
Yeah, because I was living
Yeah,
at
of course.
John's.
Yeah. Yeah, you were in that funny barn building in the back, which you had carefully ripped out everything and repositioned things, and you'd put insulation on the walls. I remember you did a lot of work on that
Oh,
building.
yeah, remodeled
God, it
it.
was huge.
Kept
Yeah, it was huge.
going.
Yeah.
Kept going until we left. Kept doing work and until we
Yeah.
left. In
And
two.
I remember you one day you were building a water tank or something.
I installed a big water tank and a
That's
pump
it.
and
That I
lines and
remember. Yeah.
but I could hire people. I could hire people. So I did a lot of work. I did a lot of digging and stuff. And then, I could get people to help me. Johnny Thorne,
Yeah.
Dennis Sampson. I've always been surrounded by skilled people, so I could do anything because of the skills of my friends. Yeah, that was great. I loved it. I had great years there. I said today on What's New blog, it's about Mel. Tomorrow, it's about my fiscal sponsors, and I have two, and one is John Terrence Pacific Zen Institute. That's the main one. That's how people
Yeah.
can donate to Cuke Archives and make tax deductions. And the second one is the Institute for Historical Studies. But I included the PZI's year-end fundraising letter, a link to it, and a picture of
Yeah.
John. Always grateful to him. He's been very helpful. I don't know where I'd
Yeah.
be without John. He's one
Well,
of the
that makes
people.
two of us. That makes two of us.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I remember sitting zazen with you in John's living room.
I stopped doing that with him because I felt it was like putting him under some pressure in his home. And so I suggested to him that we sit separately. And I continued sitting every morning, but I didn't sit with him. We did that for a while, for a couple of years, or I don't know how long. But that's too much, It's like invading a minister's home, and he ought to just have to be a minister at church. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, yeah.
And
And in some ways, and zazen is like that, though. It invades your life, it invades your home, and you're stuck with it,
yeah, that's true. But in terms of his schedule, I didn't want his
Oh,
schedule
yeah.
to be dependent
Yeah.
on that. And Katrinka and I do the same thing. We sit separately. We do yoga separately. We do everything. We do some things together, though, and that's a very nice part of it.
Yeah.
And then I got to see you again because you got together with Gupta, Ash,
Ashish, yeah.
Ashish.
Yeah.
And
And then we were together for 10 years.
you had a home in like the Sunset or
Yes.
somewhere.
No, we were in San Francisco at Castro and Beaver,
Oh,
very
in
near,
Castro and Beaver.
yeah, that's where we lived, and I was again close to Hartford Street and would go sit there from time to time.
Is Mio still running it?
Yeah, Mio was still there, yeah.
And now, how did you end up in Dharamsala?
So, Ashish had to come. His father was having first he died 2 years ago of the heart condition, but he started having trouble with his heart. And we got together in 2010, and 2011 he came to India to be with his dad, and we were both in recovery. And he had come up here working with a group called Volunteer India, and he was teaching at a home for, well, we would say challenged kids, disabled kids, mm-hmm. in Palampur, and he was looking for a meeting. And there was an AA meeting up here in McLeod Ganj at the Youngling School. And so he took a bus and he came from Palampur to McLeod and he came to the meeting. And I got a text, I got a message the next day saying, get ready to come back in India. We're coming. This was in January. Get ready to come back. We're moving. We're coming up to McLeod Ganj to volunteer with LHA starting in April. And I said, well, okay, sure. Why not? He said, you'll love it. It's near, there's the Dalai Lama's here and they got a Buddhist archive and they got some other things and it's lovely. So we started coming up and teaching English to mostly Tibetan monks and stuff. He would teach class. He taught intermediate English, and I had I tutored monks, teaching them English. And we lived in, you know, Diane's house and Claudia's house in the village we talked about before. You knew Hari. This is where I live in Yogyakarta, and we rented a house from her. And we came, and we would spend 3 months a year here. And we started, I started following these classes by a German woman who's the first woman Geshe called, she's called Kelsang Kwangmo. And Ash started, and she teaches she's German, so she's very strict and very orderly, but she teaches the Tibetan stuff in a very kind of Western way, not so much the Tibetan style. The monastic style.
Yeah.
And we started coming up here and I really liked it. So when Ash and I broke up, my choices were a basement apartment in San Francisco somewhere or McLeod Ganj. And I said, well, let's do McLeod Ganj. So I moved here about 15 months ago. I moved here in September of last year. No, more than that. Yes. So 15 months ago. Yeah. And I lived in a little building with some Tibetans. The first was here, and then Hari's building opened up, and I came down here in Yogyakarta last December and took this place. And then COVID hit, and I've been in retreat here since then.
I wanted to do a podcast with you just because I knew your trajectory of your practice was interesting to me, but I did it right now because of your Jesuit background and because it's the Christmas season. Right now we're in the third day of Christmas.
Well, I lost count, but somewhere in that neighborhood.
Yeah, right. Right. And I don't know what all those days are.
It's leading up to what they call the Epiphany, which is when the three wise men showed up at the creche of Jesus in Bethlehem, supposedly, and gave him gold, frankincense, and myrrh, and, you know, whichever story you believe. I think the British call this Boxing Day, seeing as I'm a British colony now.
Boxing Day is the 26th.
Boxing Day.
Boxing Day is the 26th.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Then that's the day in which that's the day in which you box the presents or something. Whatever happened.
I actually posted on my Cuke Nonsense blog about Boxing Day on the 26th. So you can read about it there.
I will.
I have two blogs, Cuke Zen and Cuke Nonsense. And I post on both of them pretty much 6 days a week. And I do about 6 podcasts a week, too.
Wow, you're busy.
Yeah, I am. I am, but three of them are very short. I call them mini podcasts. Now, the Epiphany then, is that the 12th day of Christmas?
That must be the 12th day of Christmas, yeah.
Oh.
Because Jesus, the infant, was already kicking around and, you know, had sprung to life or whatever happened. And they came and they said, oh, follow the star. And yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, I think so.
Yeah.
I don't know. I kind of, you know, the whole Christian mythology thing is still, it's not too present for me anymore, but certain parts of it reflect back and forth. And I go, oh, the other day we were watching, it was my friend Alex, who's a Mexican guy here. He lives, I've known him now since we started coming up. He's translates Tibetan to both to English and Spanish.
Oh,
and
wow.
Works with Geshe's and teaching. So he's learned, he's very good, and he's learned, really learned Tibetan well. He comes over, and what were we talking about? Why did he even come up? I forget.
Oh, well, we're talking about the 12 days of Christmas.
Yeah, but why? Oh, because yesterday he said, yeah, in Mexico, they celebrate Christmas somewhat differently. I think they have more presents and stuff coming up on the day of the Epiphany, which would be around the 6th of January or the 4th of January. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've been in Mexico for Christmas a couple of times. 1965. Maybe I'd gone back to Texas then, but Katrinka and Clay and I were in Todos Santos for Christmas. Oh God, how long ago? 10 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. So now you said these days, you know, the mythology of Christmas is not real important to you. You know, I just sort of go, when Steve Frost, Father Frost, who's still, you know, he's a Catholic priest, he sort of talked about it as the birth of spirit, you know, the birth of, like, how do you see, what is the, like Easter, I can see Easter as the death of the ego, right, or is it enlightenment through
I always said, you know, unless Jesus is born in your hearts, forget about
it. Yeah, there you go.
That's it for me. And if Jesus is born in your heart, then all things will be good.
That I like that. That's good. And then Kent sent me a Facebook message saying, may the baby Jesus be born in your heart. He said, that's a better way to say all that. I sort of like the other ways he said them, so I'm going to keep them. We talked about me calling him back and stuff.
Yeah, that'll be great. Just give me a call anytime.
Yeah. That's...
I don't go anywhere. I don't even go out anymore. because I'm being very, very careful here.
Yeah. Yeah, good. You should be. Well, you'll be getting a vaccine before you know it, and then you can just go romp around and
we hope.
Do whatever you want,
and then we'll be and then I have to leave India at some point then, because I'm past my residency requirement, but the Foreign Office Registry has been very accommodating.
Oh yeah, I can understand. Hey,
yeah,
they do have a 10-year visa still, don't they?
I have a 10-year visa. I have a 10-year visa, but I don't have, but you're still required to leave India. You don't have a residency requirement for more than 6 months.
Oh, you've got to leave every 6 months?
So every 180 days you have to leave India.
Where do you go?
So, Kathmandu.
Uh-huh. How's that?
It's $55 and it's, huh?
What does it cost?
Kathmandu is $55.
And with what on a bus?
On a plane.
On a plane.
From Delhi to Kathmandu, $55 to $110 round trip. Stay there 3 days, eat some food, buy some cheap masks, take a plane, come back.
Oh, just the ride
So.
from Delhi to Dharamsala is enough, man. Wow.
Well, yeah, I fly. That's the most expensive part of the
Oh, you fly from Delhi.
trip.
How close can you get
Yeah.
to Dharamsala?
Gagal, Kangra has an airport now.
How long does it take you to get from there to Dharamsala?
Oh, it's 15 minutes.
Oh, wow. I took the bus to Dharamsala and back just,
I know.
and that
And it
was,
was 8 hours of torture.
yeah. And
8 hours on this windy road up and down the mountains with these crazy bus drivers who were careening down these roads
it's
on the
frightening.
side of the hill, and you're going like, "Oh my God, what the hell have I gotten myself into?" Yeah.
And all the
Oh, I've taken it many times.
right, all the headlines I'd seen about buses going off cliffs and 40 people dying were
Yep.
reviewed in my
Yep.
mind.
Yep. Yep.
And I remember stopping in the and night buses, stopping in the middle of the
Yeah.
night
Oh,
so
yeah.
we could pee in a field
Yeah.
behind a building.
Yeah. Yes, of course. Of course.
Is it still like that?
Yep. The bus that you sell, the night bus, is still like that. Yep.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely.
Wow. Ha, ha, ha. That's funny. That's funny. All right. Well, I will review all
Give
this.
my love to Katrinka, will you? Give my love to your lovely, lovely wife.
Yeah, I'm going to head out walking. Let's see, what is it now? 4:36. I'm going to take a 30-minute walk to have dinner with her. And
Okay.
we're having an early dinner, 5:30. So I'll be leaving in 20 minutes. So this is perfect.
Okay. Well, give her my love,
Yeah,
please.
I normally don't spend. Look, what time is it? 4:38. I called you first time. One. Oh no, I talked to Elin first. Do you know Elin, my last wife? No.
Yeah, we've met.
You've met, right?
Yes,
Clay's mother.
we met. Yeah, we met. I met her once.
Yeah, she and I talked, and she wants us
Her
to talk.
dad went to the moon, right?
Well, no, he was Apollo 9. He tested the moon landing vehicle
The moon landing vehicle. Okay.
that the people who say there was no moon landing say was wouldn't have worked and was. He flew that thing 100 miles away from the mothership, whatever they called it, and back,
Wow.
and they're going 18,000 miles an hour around the Earth. And it is to get 100 miles away and back while they're going around and reconnect. And so
Amazing.
he's the first person to fly a secondary space vehicle.
Well, here, I'm going to get off the phone because I have to go get some, I have to retrieve the money that the guy took out of the ATM for me.
Hey, do it. And say hi. Say hi to Hari.
I'll show him your picture, and I'll send you a picture of him and his wife, Reshma, doing my tree, and you'll see if you recognize him.
And
All
oh
right?
yeah. And hey,
There's plenty of Haris.
does
Yeah.
he have a
Go ahead.
Facebook? Is he on Facebook?
Yes, he is.
Connect us.
How do you think? Hari. Yeah, I will.
Okay. Thanks a
I
lot. Good
will.
to talk to you.
Okay.
All right.
All right, David. Thank you so
Take
much.
care.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Happy Christmas.
Yeah. Merry Christmas.
Bye
Happy
bye.
New Year.
Happy Christmas.
Yeah. All right.
We'll
Bye bye.
chat again.
Yeah.
Bye bye.
So thanks a lot, Ken Ireland. Appreciate it. Good to talk with you. I'd love to go back to Dharamsala. I don't know if I ever will. It's an interesting place and really a good exercise to be around there. So until next time, this is DC Booba of Cuke Audio and Cuke Archives, coming to you from Sleepy Sanur with Doggett Bandita, Feline Cuchita, and dear lovely Katrinka. And we're wishing you and yours and all of us a grand awakening.